Sure. Thanks, Kim. Thanks to Kim and Terry for inviting me here. I've had a good week and a half so far. I'm looking forward to the rest of my time here. I figured what I would do today is go a little bit into the details of how I've been trying to model the development of bacteriophage T7, mainly to give you a lot of, and with the hopes of giving you a fair amount of realism and stuff to push off against. So please ask if you have questions and whatnot as we go through. But I'm going to give a brief intro into how I think about modeling biological systems and what I'm really interested in applying such models for. We'll go through the T7 model, have some concluding thoughts on modeling, and probably not this morning, maybe offline or later, I could talk about the pheromone signal transduction pathway model that we've been working on for about the last 2 years. And I have a bunch of other projects I've been involved with that I'd like to talk about with people here. So I see it, modeling as having a bunch of different complementing approaches. So the first sort of approach might be a top-down existing data approach. You have, for instance, expression array data, and in perhaps one case, you'd like to infer the underlying regulatory architecture of the genetic network. Maybe that works, maybe it doesn't. Remains to be demonstrated so far as I'm concerned. I think one of the big concerns I have with approaches like that is they fail to ask critically if the data type you're generating is sufficient to answer the question you want to ask. Then you have a bottom-up existing data approach. I think Adam Arkin's example with Harley McAdam and Lucy Shapiro's on the lambda genetic switch is excellent. But it's floating on top of existing data. So that's sort of the high watermark of traditional biological modeling. It's been floating on top of whatever data is available, and we really are just now starting to get into the situation where the models are integrating into the experimental efforts and hopefully driving a coupled approach of developing models and validating them and generating new knowledge. So that's the third class of model. Bacteriophage T7 model, I think you'll see, is in that class. Yeast pheromone mating response is in that class. There's no formal distinction between two and three here other than one's floating on top of existing data and the other is explicitly trying to integrate into generating new data. And then we have another type which Michael gave an excellent example of yesterday. Tim Gardner and Jim Collins have done some work on the bistable switch as well, which you're probably aware of. If I have time, I might talk about a synthetic bacteriophage I'm trying to make now. But the idea here is that if we want to have models of biological systems, it seems as likely a successful approach to refactor or design new systems as it is to study and validate models for existing systems, which suffer from being rather subtle. And then I think Michael Savageau and John Doyle had some really nice examples of how you could have somewhat more abstract but very value-adding models of biological systems that help you interpret what the function of the system is and what it needs to do in order to affect that function. So my personal bias is going to be on the bottom half of this, 3, 4, and 5. I think eventually we might see things from point one integrating with these more forward-based, mechanism-based modeling approaches. I don't see how that integration occurs naturally, but it probably will. You may have gotten some of this before, but I want to emphasize again that biology has a really good history of building models. And I think the best example of this is obviously the Lac operon. And if you haven't read the book by Mueller-Hill in 96, that's an incredible book. It's sort of like Potashny's genetic switch, but about an order of magnitude more sophisticated and honest in terms of how people were formulating hypotheses, validating them, failing with their hypotheses and whatnot. And so an approximate representation of this model, with apologies for not having everything completely up to date and showing all the sophistication, is you have a repressor LacI, it's binding the operator, repressing transcription of Z, Y, and A not shown. This is repressed state. You have an induced state where your inducer removes the repressor from the operator, transcription begins. So here you have two qualitatively distinct states. This is the model that came out of that work described by Benno, and it's pretty obvious. In Well, it's not obvious, but the point I want to make is biologists have been building models, and they've been doing it really well. And usually the theorists have been the experimentalists, and the hypotheses coming out of the theories and the mechanisms that were suggested were made by the same people doing the experiments. I'm not proposing or suggesting that we do anything different than that. All I'm interested in doing is extending what I mean by model, so wherein we might have a qualitative model on the left that has two different states. Now I might annotate that with something that looks like mass action and approximate the time-dependent behavior of this system. So here is the off state or repressed state, and this is the induced state. The only difference here is the states are not time invariant. There's some things going on here. And it's not as easy, although it is clearly possible, to discriminate one state from the other. There's nothing particular in this model. It's just showing IPTG comes in and expression of beta gal goes up. You can see that there's some low-level expression here. The capacity in the system is probably not as high as it really is. It's only about a factor of 1,000. Okay, so let me try and make this point as well. I don't think I'm talking about making physically realistic representations of these systems. I don't pretend to be able to do that. All I'm really interested in doing, again, is getting some access to the time-dependent behavior. To the extent that biological systems are dynamic, looking at their dynamic behavior at one level vastly increases the range of phenotypes that are accessible to experimentation. So at the most primitive level, that's one motivation for doing this. It's not necessarily, again, to make a physically realistic representation of the process. And I think there are a couple reasons why we shouldn't expect to do this. Michael has done some just beautiful work, for instance, looking at the apparent diffusion coefficient of GFP in the coli cytoplasm, and it's 11-fold lower than water, roughly. And if you put some HIS tags on it, it drops by another 40%, and we can let Michael talk about this more this afternoon. But the point here is it's not immediately apparent how these molecules inside the cytosol of even something like coli are actually working. Here's another example that came out a couple years ago now, which maybe you've seen. This is MinC fused with GFP in E. coli. And so here's MinC is a protein that represses cytokinesis, septum formation, in the middle of the cell during division. And people, when they made a MinC GFP fusion, found that it was localized to the poles of the cell. But then when people looked at live cells, they found that, and Andrew Murray isn't apparently convinced that this is true, but I think it is, that and the reviewers apparently thought it was, that the localized MinC GFP fusion was actually bouncing back and forth from pole to pole. And the time scale here is in seconds. This is in a cell that's dividing around once every 180 minutes. So this is just to emphasize that, for instance, coli is certainly not a well-mixed bag of chemicals. We don't necessarily understand really well how things are localized. When we go through the T7 model, if you remind me, I can point out some of the instances where things are certainly not localized, although I've not included that in my model. Okay, so are we going to make a model for something like this process anytime soon? No, is the quick answer to that, so far as I'm concerned. And the reasons are we don't have a specification of the system, we don't know what the transition rules, we don't know what the physics relevant to the system are. We're not sure what level of resolution to use to represent the system. We probably don't have the computational methods or power, although let's ignore that. I'm happy to build methods that require the computational power of a decade from now. And we don't know what the purpose or function of these systems are. We don't understand what problems they're trying to solve. And I think that becomes, again, as John Doyle was alluding to last week, an as important problem to go after as thinking about specifying the systems. Okay, so let me introduce you to bacteriophage T7 for those of you who haven't seen it. So this is a TEM image. The particle here is about 62 nanometers in diameter. And what you're seeing here is a short tail hanging off the bottom, or on the bottom. And this is from Novagen, who made this little cartoon or schema. They use T7 to display variable libraries on the capsid and on the capsid, just in T7. So you have this capsid, the DNA is inside the capsid, it lands on the cell, binds the cell, and somehow the DNA comes in through here into the cell, the process of infection begins. Basically what happens is, let me table that. We'll go through that in a second. So what do we know about T7 specifically? Well, T7 was isolated by Demirak and Fano in 1944. And if you read their paper, they say that it was isolated from the standard anticholyphage mixture prepared by Dr. Ward McNeil. I don't know where McNeil got it. He was at the New York Postgraduate Medical School and Hospital. He got his PhD MD from Michigan around the turn of the century. So sometime between the turn of the century and mid-40s, McNeil grabbed a bunch of phage, most likely from the sewers of Manhattan, I'm guessing, and within that, T7 was there, and as such, it became isolated later by Demirak and Fano. So the thing to really appreciate is that what we're describing as the wild-type T7 is really an arbitrary isolate of something that was found to be useful for destroying coli. So the early history of phage is that they were used as, they were being pursued as therapeutics before antibiotics were generated. And that's another story, but people are thinking about doing that again. Anyway, so the T7 genome was sequenced in 82. It's just under 40 kb. It was 100% sequence. You know, we don't have any of these problems. There are 56 genes thought to encode 60 proteins. We have primary function assigned to 33. And there's at least 50 regulatory elements having to do with the processing of messages, the rates of transcription and translation and whatnot, the stability of the message and so on. T7 had a protein linkage map by two hybrid back in 96. It was the first organism for which there was a genome scale two hybrid interaction assay. The data from that and the data from all these genome two hybrid assays, I have very strong opinions on with respect to how valuable it is. And we can go into that later if you like. In short though, the T7 data, this was more a demonstration than it was an actual production of useful data. The polymerases, T7 DNA and RNA polymerases, are extremely well characterized, mainly because the T7 DNA polymerase is small. It has some 3' to 5' exonucleolytic activity, so it has a relatively low error rate for a simple DNA polymerase. Charlie Richardson and other people have done a great job on that. The T7 RNA polymerase has been well studied because it's used in recombinant expression a lot. Tom Schneider and Gary actually have done some really cool work looking at the information content in the T7 promoters. So there's about, literally half a century of biology on T7. Sure.
Protein linkage map via yeast two hybrid Bartlett type. The only words I understand there is Bartlett type.
Okay. So. So.
What is this protein linkage map, for example?
Sure. So. Let's say you have an organism with 50 genes, and you want to know which proteins encoded by those genes interact with which other proteins. So you can make a diagonal matrix. 1 through 50, 1 through 50. And if one interacts with 1, if one interacts with 25, right? Yes.
Now,
yeah.
Presumably, viruses in coli, you want to have the same map.
That's something I'm setting up to do. Okay. It hasn't been done against coli. One of the things that makes T7 nice as a model system is, for example, unlike lambda, T7 effectively shuts down the host within 5 minutes of infection. So if anything's going to turn coli into a static bag of chemicals, it's going to be T7, with the exception of T1, but you don't want to study T1 because all of your biologist friends will hate you, because it T1 does nasty. If you could go to Harvard now and isolate T1 from the drop ceiling panels. It's very stable as a particle and extremely lytic and wipes out cultures. There were real problems with unintentional T1 infections back in the day. But most, you can fix that in some ways, but you have to switch all of your coli strains. So T7 is a nice system, a nice model system to think about in terms of something that's capable of self-replication, but doesn't have to deal with the complexity of a whole cell. Right. Right. There's a heck of a lot of host-phage interaction with T7 that we don't know about. it probably isn't as much as with Lambda. It's probably not as much. I mean, another thing that might be suggested is why not do all this for a simpler phage or a smaller phage, I should say, like PhiX-174 or VSV, which are, or HIV, which are all around 6 kilobases or less. And I think the obvious reason there is the host interactions are way more serious and much less well-characterized. So protein interaction map, diagonal matrix, that at the most qualitative level, right? You take, does this protein interact with this protein, this one with this one, this one with this one, just to get some idea of the connectivity. 2-hybrid is an assay developed by Stan Fields, wherein in yeast, this is probably a review, the transcriptional regulators in eukaryotes and yeast are modular so that they have a DNA binding domain and a transcription activating domain. You can separate them and they will still work, which means that if you have 2 proteins of interest that you want to see if they interact with each other, you can make a fusion, one to the DNA binding domain, one to the transcriptional activating domain. And if those 2 proteins that you're interested in interacting do in fact interact, they localize they interact and bring the transcriptional activating domain to the DNA binding domain, thereby turning on transcription of a reporter. So it's a biological hack that's used as an observational technology. Okay. So just to provide you some background here, I did not get into the process of modeling T7 for anything that would be recognized as an intelligent reason. So in 1994, I was a graduate student in John Yin's lab at Dartmouth, and he had just come back from working with Manfred Eigen and thinking about quasi-species, and he was really stoked on evolution. And so what he wanted to do was develop automated ways of tracking evolving populations. And they had been doing some stuff in Germany with RNA replication, but he wanted to use an existing living system. And he decided to use T7. And he decided to use T7 for the following reason, arbitrary reason, so far as I'm concerned. That is that, so this is a plaque. This is a petri dish with a lawn of E. coli. A T7 particle was at the middle of each of these circles at time zero, and it started growing or eating a hole in the lawn of E. coli. And it grows out. It's a reaction diffusion process. This scale right here is a centimeter. And this is, I believe, 5, 12, 24, and 50 hours post-infection. Now, the thing about T7 is most phage, the lawn on a petri dish like this will go stationary probably within less than 10 hours. And most phage stop propagating. Their plaques stop growing once the lawn or the cells go into stationary phase. T7 doesn't do that. It continues to propagate. So you can basically make infinite-sized plaques, so long as you have really big petri dishes. And that's what you're seeing here. So that just turned out to be nice from the standpoint of thinking about how is this thing evolving. So what John was doing was he was setting up different environments in which the phage could evolve and looking to see how mutations arose. And the way he was looking to see how mutations arose was to see how circular these plaques were. So along each radius is sort of a history of phage. And if a mutation occurs in this direction, the rate at which the phage will propagate or the rate at which the plaque will grow will increase if it's a beneficial mutation. If it's a deleterious mutation, the rate will decrease and that will be lost. But if it's a beneficial mutation, the rate will increase and you'll get a slight bulge. And if you look closely, you can actually see a slight bulge right here. And you can certainly see that this isn't round either. And so the trick with this assay was just to establish it in such a way that when there weren't mutations, you were getting as close to a round plaque as you could detect. And when there were mutations, you were getting sectoring or bulging. And then what John was doing was he was taking, for instance, stabs along radii and doing restriction analysis and sequencing. And so a radius here will give you a time course of the evolution of a particular lineage of phage. So you could see how mutations were sweeping through the not through the population, but through an individual lineage. So this was all happening when I got there. And some of the mutants that were coming off of this lineage, for instance, were deleted for a couple genes and were growing a lot better than the wild type. And as engineers, we didn't appreciate or couldn't intuit why these particular mutations would grow faster. And being in a chemical engineering environment, the idea was to make a chemical kinetic model for the entirety of T7 development in the hopes of gaining understanding for why these particular mutations conferred faster growth. So it's a wonderfully naive way of trying to gain understanding.
How did the phages random walk around?
Yeah, so you lose about 0.86 millimeters a day to diffusion in this setup. So this is at about 50 hours. Again, this is 10 millimeters or 1 centimeter. So yeah, you can't let this sit there forever. But within the time scale relevant to how fast the plaque is growing, the blurring isn't a huge, huge problem. This is some of the early stuff. The later stuff actually was digital cameras and automated image processing and whatnot. Anyway, so the point was, we tried to do this in order to understand these mutants that were growing faster than wild type. We weren't sure that we could integrate the 50 years of T7 biology to create a representation that made any sense. Was another sort of open question. So the purpose of this slide is just to show you that the T7 genome is a pretty interesting genome, and it's interesting despite the fact that, unlike Lambda, T7 isn't making a decision. The only decision T7 is making is this implicit decision to continue to exist. But it's not making a lysis-lysogeny decision. It's a strongly lytic phage. It gets into the cell at 37 degrees. 17 minutes later, the cell is completely destroyed, and there are hundreds of copies of the phage. The host genome is degraded completely, or around 85%. So it's a really nasty phage. It just gets in, destroys, and gets out. So if you look at the genome, this is the beginning, this is the end, and there are arbitrarily sort of, I just label it as different regions. People usually just go early, middle, late, but it's I think it's more useful to think about it this way. So the early genes, this first gene, 0.3, what does it do? It gets into the cell and it inhibits the host restriction systems that might otherwise degrade the phage genome. So it's an anti-immune system for the primitive immune system of the host, if you want to think about it, Coli restriction systems as being an immune system. 0.7 is a protein kinase. It phosphorylates about 40 host proteins. We don't have a clue what that does. It also inhibits the E. coli RNA polymerase by a mechanism not dependent on phosphorylation.
What are the fraction numbers?
Yeah, good question. So the original annotation of the T7 genome was done before we had sequencing, right? Or complete sequencing, at least. And so what people were doing was doing a bunch of restriction mapping and mutation swaps. And the original genes that were discovered were the integer number of genes. And then when they got a bunch more data and then got the sequence data, they went in and found more genes. So one was found, and then, oh no, we found, actually, there's about 6 genes upstream of one. Whatever. I apologize. The names aren't so informative. Yeah, it's a linear. So far as we know, and when we get into it a little more, you'll see this has a lot to do with two factors, we believe. One is the entry mechanism for T7 DNA, and then the other is the fact that T7 DNA is very highly expressed. And I don't think you want to have a lot of potential collision events. So I think, Michael, you might remember more than I, but the really highly expressed regions of the Coli genome, for instance, are the orientation of the ORFs is in the same direction as the way the direction that the replication fork is propagating.
I think that's true.
Yeah, I think Andrew Murray was saying that as well last week. Okay, so this is an anti-immune system. This shuts down the Coli polymerase. This replaces it with the T7 polymerase. I'm just going to give you some arbitrary functions to go with these arbitrary numbers. 3 is an endonuclease, which will attack the E. coli genome. 6 is an exonuclease, which will degrade those fragments. So these two things conspire to completely degrade the Coli genome over a 7-minute period. 85% of those bases will become T7 genomes. That happens via the T7 polymerase, the primase helicase. Then here you have a bunch of particle genes. You've got the head-tail connector, which is the ring that the capsid sits on. You've got a scaffold that is used to build the capsid, the major and minor capsid proteins, tail fibers, and then core. And then at the end, you have things related to how are we going to get the replicated DNA into the prohead? How are we going to exit or lyse the cell? And that actually weirdly involves something that's way back here. But the point here is you can sort of walk through this, and there seems to be some basic logic, or the way the genes are encoded represent the function of the genes. So I don't know if I would consider T7 to be one entire module of E. coli, that is a module for destroying E. coli. I don't know if I would consider these to be modules or submodules. We can come back to that.
So what's the success rate of T7 killing E. coli?
It's pretty high. There isn't, well, 90%, over 90% of particles can form infective centers. I don't know of anybody doing really high quality single cell, single particle, single cell infection experiments, and that would be very cool to do. Some of the classic experiments back in the day, well, yeah, so I don't know. But my impression is it's pretty high. It's much, much higher than Lambda, for instance. Okay, so the T7 model is really nothing more than a coupled series of smaller models. There's a model for DNA entry, there's a model for transcription, for translation, for replication, for prohead assembly, for packaging of DNA, for particle assembly, and there's a model for lysis, but it's not included, and we'll get back to that. What you also should pick up as I go through this is the models get worse as we go down this list, and that'll be clear. So let's start with the model for DNA entry. So you've got a phage particle, it's outside the cell, it's got a bunch of DNA inside of it. How does it get into the cell? Well, first thing you need to forget about is this idea of phage injecting their DNA into the cell. This isn't under pressure, so far as we can tell. And furthermore, the tail isn't long enough to span the periplasm. So there isn't some needle that goes in this instance. So what's thought to happen is these core proteins somehow span the periplasm, and this GP15 protein, it's a really primitive, crude hypothesis right now, but it forms a rotor that burns ATP and spins against the GP16, which would be a stator. And as it spins, it pulls the DNA into the cell. Yes? This is all contained within the infecting particle so far. Now, the thing about T7 DNA entry is it was found to take a really, really long time. And so the lab I was in Texas did the experiments to sort of confirm and get the kinetics on how this was working. And I want to just walk you through that because I want to give you a feel for what the quality of the data that's being used to build the model and set the kinetic parameters and stuff like that is. So here's the experiment, okay? So first off, it was observed that T7 DNA entry took a long time. And by a long time, I mean on the order of 8 minutes in a 20 or 30 minute growth cycle, as opposed to Lambda, which gets in within 30 seconds. So the way these experiments were done, and people also had a clue that it had something to do with transcription or translation. So for instance, if you blocked protein synthesis by adding chloramphenicol, you could get a different entry pattern. What people would do then is, this is the state-of-the-art assay for how people understand the mode of T7 DNA entry. You take a T7 genome and you look at the DPN1 sites, and there aren't enough, so you add some new ones. And DPN1 is a restriction enzyme that only cuts at methylated DNA usually. So then what you do is you infect with a bunch of unmethylated T7 DNA, and you infect into a cell that overexpresses the enzyme that methylates DNA, the damn methylase. And then what you do is you isolate DNA at different time points and do a restriction digest with DPN1. So here are different time points, and you're looking under these conditions to see which restriction fragments occur when. So this is the beginning of the genome, this is the end of the genome, and if you look, for instance, you'll see this restriction fragment B shows up around 3 minutes, whereas this restriction fragment A shows up much, much later. And if you make a plot for when these restriction fragments are first seen versus time, you get a curve that looks like this. And this is the data for an assay where entry can only be affected by the E. coli RNA polymerase. And if you look at this, you'll see you're getting about 20 kb over 6 to 14 minutes, which corresponds to a rate of entry of about 40 base pairs per second, which coincidentally appears to be the rate of elongation of the E. coli RNA polymerase. If you repeat the experiment under conditions where the T7 polymerase is active, you get a different rate that's approximately 200 to 300 base pairs per second, which is coincidentally the rate of elongation of the T7 RNA polymerase. So that's the high watermark of the data that's leading us to believe that entry in T7 is mediated by the polymerases beyond this initial region. So let me show you the model explicitly at this point. So there's three phases of entry. One is about 800 base pairs of DNA gets into the cell. We think it's by this molecular motor. We really don't know. The rate is somewhere between 5 and 65 base pairs per second as measured by this restriction assay. On this region are three promoters for the Coli RNA polymerase. The Coli polymerase recognizes these promoters. These are, as an aside, these are really strong promoters. Some of the best promoters you're going to find for the Coli polymerase. It recognizes, initiates transcription, it abuts against the inner membrane, and instead of falling off, the enzyme pulls the DNA into the cell at the rate of elongation. It pulls in the gene encoding, among others, the T7 RNA polymerase. Immediately downstream of this gene are two promoters for the T7 RNA polymerase. Once that RNA polymerase is synthesized, because it's about five-fold faster, it displaces, the baton is passed, it displaces the Coli polymerase and brings in the rest of the genome.
The data that you showed before on the previous slide, it seems you could, that might be enough to have a quantitative model. For instance, are you getting diffusive behavior through, or are you getting linear behavior through, plus the distribution of velocities of this thing?
Yeah. Well, so again, those are population measurements. Uh-huh. Yes, you can do this over a range of temperatures with a bunch of different mutants. So for instance, you can expand, you can actually get this phase to go for the entire genome and look to see what the temperature dependence of that is. And we really haven't figured out, it looks like it's an enzyme catalyzed reaction, but Ian Molyneux hasn't quite really believed any particular hypothesis versus another. I think this is clearly an example where it would be nice to bring more sophisticated observation technologies to get after the questions you were suggesting. I think you can get bulk rates, was all I was really implying, right? Yes, Gary?
So earlier you mentioned that T7 will continue to grow and expand on stationary E. coli.
Right.
Does that imply that those early promoters can actually be recognized by the
sigma factor independent. Yeah. Doesn't. I don't know. It's.
I mean, those were identified because they were strong sigma 70 promoters, I think, or at least that's what they were. And in those days, they didn't know that there were multiple sigma factors.
So for instance, the T7 RNA polymerase was originally thought to be a sigma factor, right? Because it was redirecting transcription. So I might be getting that mixed up, and you may be right. Regardless, yes, it would imply that entry can happen in stationary phase. So if that requires sigma factors, as you're suggesting, they would have to be active. It's not really well understood, though. It seems like, here's an example where the cell isn't well mixed. It seems like the initial region of DNA isn't accessible. So the initial region of DNA that's encoding the enzymes that inhibit the host restriction system is not accessible to restriction itself. So somehow it's being sequestered near the membrane, and we have no idea what's going on there. So it's really an open, there's a lot of open questions here.
Can T7 just land anywhere on the bacteria? Is it part of the receptor?
It's not specific like a lambda going in.
So how does it know it's a E. coli?
Don't know that. Well, man. Well, we can. Actually, I can answer that, but that's, let's table that. This is going to be about 3 to 6 kilobases on the genome from the left end. This is around 800 bases right here. Okay. So if you put in this mechanism and sort of have qualitative switching. You know, if Coli polymerase in cell and Coli promoter in cell, then switch to this mode of entry. If T7 polymerase expressed and T7 polymerase promoter in cell, switch to last mode of entry. If you put in something like that, this is the DNA in the cell as a function of time. And this is the observed data from some early experiments. So it's not perfect, but you know, it's good enough to work with to begin. And what you're seeing here is the slow mode of entry that's not polymerase mediated, the Coli polymerase mediated, and then the T7 polymerase mediated. And the experimental data doesn't have enough time resolution to distinguish those transitions. Probably. There certainly are.
I just noticed that the slope seemed to be actually faster than the fastest polymerase, which seemed a little bit...
Here's a point to make, right? When I originally made this model, starting in 94, it took me about 6 months to make a model that worked. And there's a lot of slop in building a model like this. For instance, the T7 polymerase elongation rate is somewhere between 200 and 300 base pairs per second. What rate should you use? You know, we sort of arbitrarily picked the middle rate now. But before, what I was doing was actively choosing parameter values within the acceptable ranges of the experimental data to have things that would line up. So if we crank this up by another 50 base pairs per second, it would probably be okay. The point being, though, once I made that model after, it was trivial to make a model that worked in about a 6 month time period, but the hypothesis, we'll see this later, the hypothesis I was getting off this model were not compelling, meaning I didn't want to do any experiments to test these hypotheses, which so far as I can tell is the only filter that distinguishes a good model from a bad model in biology right now. And what that led to was a much longer process of about 2 or 3 years wherein we went back and very carefully were explicit where we were making assumptions. So I stopped worrying about how well the data matched at a very fine level of resolution.
So Drew, until your model, nobody really knew how T7 got into factory?
No, I don't think that's certainly not true. We're not anywhere near getting to a hypothesis that isn't self-evident to, for example, Bill Studier or any other really good T7 biologist. And if we're lucky, maybe we get to that at the end of the talk. Okay, here's something just to point out. This model is not resolved at the level of sequence, right? It's resolved at the level of functional genetic elements. So this is another way, and just to bring you into this schema here, the boxes here represent the genes. These periscopes are promoters. These are the Coli polymerase promoters. The green ones are the T7 polymerase promoters. The heights here are proportional to their expected strength. Sometimes this has been measured in vitro. More often than not, it hasn't. These are terminators for transcription, and these are RNase-3 recognition sites where messenger RNA is cut. So this is just another way of looking at it. You can see, for instance, here's a strong promoter upstream of this gene, 10, which is the capsid gene, just upstream of a terminator. So there's going to be a lot of expression over this region of DNA, you would expect. But the point here, again, is because we can't go from sequence to structure to function, we're not anywhere near making a nucleotide-level resolution model. The only exception in T7 might be at the level of promoter regions, where over a 23 base pair consensus region, you can make some decent approximations for how promoter polymerase binding and isomerization efficiency relate to nucleotide sequence.
What makes sequence?
Give me a pointer.
Sure.
Here's a way to visualize patterns in the sequences. If you have a sharp eye, you may recognize column here, 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 column of A and G's. Or this is a smear due to computer.
Ah.
The period is 22.
Yeah.
So that just means that he happens to have the right number of characters in each line.
No. A simpler way to explain it, perhaps, is a computer smear.
Yeah.
Question, why are there so few terminators compared to the number of promoters?
Naive answer. T7 doesn't have time to stop things. We don't know. Here's some fundamental questions. Why are there so many promoters? Why do they have this particular order? We're going to get to stuff like that. You know, what does this represent as a genome? How is the information encoded in this genome at all reflecting the environment that this thing was isolated from or optimized for?
That means that terminators are not as important.
Well, you know, here's something to consider, right? Here's the classic example. Again, you don't need a model to appreciate this. This gene right here in this little box is 11. It's part of the tail, and it's downstream of this terminator. So it's part of the particle. You absolutely have to have it to have a viable particle. There's no promoter upstream of it, downstream of the terminator. So the only way it gets expressed at all is if there's read-through at this terminator. So you can look at this and qualitatively infer that this terminator cannot be 100% efficient. Otherwise, it would be fatal. Right? So that's sort of the level at which, as I got into this, people appreciated the encoding of the information. Here's another question. This is the T7 RNA polymerase. It's upstream of all promoters for the T7 RNA polymerase, which means that it doesn't self-express. As is well known, if you have a self-expressing T7 RNA polymerase system, you can do some real damage to a cell, basically deplete a lot of resources making copies of T7 RNA polymerase. Why is that? There's a T7-like phage, T3, that has an active promoter for the T7 RNA polymerase up here. It looks like it's a very weak promoter. So we can come back to that again, but there's some design. Now, again, this is an arbitrary example, right? But it seems like there's some design choices that have been made in the system.
Can I just ask whether all those genes are on one mRNA, or is there a separate
No.
mRNA?
Right. So you're getting in this at least about, if you have complete digestion, well, we'll see that on the next slide. You're getting about 32 different mRNA species if there's complete digestion of the message at the RNase 3 sites. If there isn't, and you're getting fractional digests, there's hundreds of mRNA species. But the pink things are RNase 3 recognition sites. So the mRNA is made, forms a hairpin loop, an enzyme binds and cuts with some efficiency. Let me show you the next slide. Here's a schema for how you get different mRNA species from a genome with this organization. So at some arbitrary point T in time, you have some length of the T7 genome in the cell. And in this particular schema, we've got three promoters for the T7 RNA polymerase, one terminator, and one RNase 3 recognition site. So one species of message you could get would be start at this promoter, read through the terminator because it's not completely efficient, and keep reading through, but get processed at this RNase 3 recognition site. So you're generating species A and F in this case. Okay, here's another species, B, starts at this promoter, stops at this terminator. Here's a species that starts at this promoter, reads through, keeps reading through, gets cut, produces C and F. Here's a species, D, starts here, stops. Here's a species that starts here, reads through, gets cut. So I'm not showing you any incomplete or partial digestion of the RNase 3 sites here. If I were, there'd be another species that went all the way through here. It looks like it's sufficient, for example, to have a single E. coli RNA polymerase molecule pull in the entire genome. So that one would think that if a molecule fell off, that another one would have to come and make it through. Yeah, I think the logical answer to your question, or what you would intuit as having to be true, is what we would believe to be true. I have no reason to think otherwise. I don't think there are a lot of examples of the terminator for the T7 RNA polymerase. Don't know. Can find that out for you. Okay, so this is going to be a really reduced model for transcription and translation. The basic way it works is RNA polymerase is assigned to each promoter as a function of the polymerase promoter binding strength and isomerization efficiency. That gives you a RNA polymerase. From that, you can compute an RNA polymerase density over each message. And using that, you can have a first order mRNA concentration dependence for rates of translation. So let me show. Yes?
This is terminated T0 is a terminator for 10A, 10B,
It's a terminator for any RNA polymerase, T7 RNA polymerase, that's initiating transcription upstream of this and hits it. So
okay.
it
there's 10B.
Yeah, oh, it's for both. It's downstream of both.
Both. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And the different species, the messengers and then combinations of 3.5 and 11 in one case.
Right. So here you would have a polycistronic message encoding three different genes. Right. And you might have, and then you would have four different messages, though, that could encode gene 10A for this simple schema.
And the ribosome transcriptome?
Right. Each has a unique or individual RBSs and start and stop.
Two things. Is E doing anything, or is E just?
Is E doing anything? Not in this schema, no.
Okay. How does F occur?
F occurs via. F can occur from polymerase initiating at either this promoter, or this promoter.
And
this promoter, this, yeah, so this promoter would be, here's the message, it gets cut at this site, you make E and F. Here's a message, it reads through, it gets cut, you make A and F. Okay, so these are pretty simple rate equations. For the ith message and the ith protein. And what you're seeing is there are two source terms, one for the host polymerase and one for the T7 polymerase. This is the rate of elongation of these two polymerases. The S terms represent the integrated strength of all of the upstream promoters and terminators and regulatory elements. And it's basically a weighted sum, and I can walk through that offline. It's not that sophisticated or impressive, actually. It's just, it's a logical extension of the causal sort of links you saw here. So this message would be contributed to by these three promoters. These two promoters would be reduced by this terminator. The system is complicated because there are two RNA polymerase systems. So that's why there are two source terms for the mRNA rate equation. Again, host and phage polymerase. Then you have a decay term for the message. This is effectively zero. It turns out for T7, the T7 message are really stable. Last we checked, and that was a long time ago, meaning in the 70s. And that needs to be checked again for reasons we'll get to. This is the rate of translation and then protein decay. This is a function of the message concentration, the ribosome density on the message, and the rate of translation. Decay is, again, dependent on concentration of the protein. And then this term accounts for interaction with other molecules, assembly into the particle, and so on. So I would call this a reduced, not physically realistic model for the process, similar to what Michael was showing yesterday, not as high resolution as what Adam Arkin has used for Lambda. But it's sufficient to, I think, make some initial progress. And so this plot here shows, and I should state bluntly that I'm using a I'm not using a stochastic method to integrate these equations. This is a deterministic method, and I think I can get away with it in T7 for reasons I can come back to. But this shows the number of polymerase molecules initiating from the different promoters from the beginning of the genome to the end of the genome as a function of time post-infection. So all this is illustrating is you're getting a bunch of interesting dynamics. So these promoters are up early on, but then as the genome's coming into the cell and more promoters enter the cell, the later promoters, which if you go back and look at the genome, you see that these promoters are much stronger. It's thought that it looks like the T7 RNA polymerase is limiting, and so these promoters outcompete the early weaker promoters for the polymerase, and that helps shift the transcription resources to the middle and late regions of the genome later in infection. So, yeah.
So that implies that the polymerase is actually limited.
Yes. Yes. And I have arguments with, for example, Ian Molyneux about that. I think that's true.
And at what point, what time does DNA replication start?
A little bit later than that. 12 minutes. Yeah. I should point out, most of the experiments are actually done at 30 degrees because at 37 things happen too quickly. So when I talk about the dynamics or kinetics, with the respect to the model, everything's at 30 degrees, which is, instead of being a 17-minute growth cycle, about a 30-minute growth cycle.
Is the depletion of the function
It's T7 RNA polymerase limited, meaning that there are a couple hundred, so there's a couple things going on here. One is the T7 polymerase is going to be inhibited by the T7 lysozyme. So you have to think about the active level of polymerase, not the total amount of polymerase. And then once you start to look at that, you find that it looks like there's only a couple hundred molecules of the polymerase, which is not enough to saturate a 40 kb genome. There's no gene expression of the newly replicated DNA, so you don't have a dilution effect because you've just made 100 more copies of the genome. Replication or gene expression seems like it's stopped by the time replication really gets going.
So there must be in your model, you have a volume dilution.
Yeah, that's right. There's a concentration. Yeah, and well, so. Yes, and 8 × 10⁻⁶ liters. So it does, that's what, clearly transcription is one of the reasons, you would not expect this to be a necessarily accurate representation when you have molecules, single molecules and small number molecules. But I don't think we're getting systematic deviations. What we may be missing is there might be some fraction of growth cycles which don't work that we're not detecting by using a non-stochastic method. But we're not, for example, dealing with lysis-lysogeny. Okay. So here's an experiment I did and output of the model. So this experiment is to track protein synthesis during infection. It's a pulse chase labeling experiment, which basically means you grow up cells in media lacking cysteine and methionine, two amino acids containing sulfur. You hit them with cysteine and methionine containing S35, which means you're going to be able to detect newly synthesized proteins. You allow the cells or the phage infecting those cells to incorporate the S35 into their proteins over a 90-second window, and then you chase it with non-radioactive cysteine and methionine. And so what you end up getting is a snapshot for what proteins were synthesized over a 90-second window throughout the growth cycle. So this is 90-second snapshots at 0 to 90 seconds, 2 minutes to 2 minutes plus 90 seconds. Throughout the growth cycle, these are uninfected cells. You run this out on a gradient acrylamide gel and separate, usually on the basis of mass. No. So what you're seeing here are only those proteins that do contain those amino acids. You put it in the coli. So that it gets incorporated during the infection. You put it in the media. The coli are actively bringing in resources from their environment. Since they were lacking cysteine and methionine, they're eager to bring that in.
How come the methionine initiation methionine is not there?
If they feed off a large fraction of something.
Yeah. Okay, so what you're seeing here is you're seeing the protein synthesis of the host, these sort of light bands here that goes away. And maybe what I'll do is just get through this slide and the next one and then take a break and we'll come back and talk about application of the simulation. So the host protein synthesis is stopping. You can see that some early proteins are coming on early. So this is the T7 RNA polymerase. It's coming on and going off. This is a part of the core particle protein. It's coming on relatively strong and staying on. This is the major capsid protein overlapping with the scaffold and the exonuclease. And the scaffold protein, I'm sorry, the major capsid protein, 10A, you're making about 50,000 copies of this protein within 10 minutes. So it's pretty highly expressed. That's why you get a big band. And when you look over here, I'm not simulating running things out on a gel. I'm just looking at the rates of protein synthesis. And when you compare stuff, you can look at a couple different things seem to be useful. One is the time of first expression that has to do with are we getting entry right and transcription and translation. And then the other is the relative rates. And then the last is are we down-regulating protein synthesis correctly. And what I'm going to argue or submit is that we're doing okay with time of first synthesis. We're doing okay with relative levels, more or less. For instance, 10A and 16 are really high. One's pretty strong. But we're doing really poorly with respect to downregulation of protein synthesis for the early and middle genes. So one is clearly turned off, 1.3 is turned off, 2.5 is turned off. And there's a couple more which are cut off down below. And you can see that one stays on. So here's another basic value add from a model. I think that instead of having to be, for instance, in the case of yeast pheromone signal transduction, Jeremy Thorner or Herskowitz or Andrew Murray, with accumulated wisdom of decades from which you can approach and formulate hypotheses about the system, if you have a model that's based on what's known, that's not overfitted, you can use it, the output of the model, in direct comparison with relatively trivial experiments to do and see where the gaping holes are, right? And so this suggests that we obviously don't know something about T7 protein synthesis. It's not that this wasn't known before the model was built. It's just that the model makes this painfully clear to anybody who's using the model. So I think there's a whole sort of sociological switchover that has to happen in biology. People have to be willing to upload the accumulated knowledge and information they have and make sort of distributed and open representations of biological systems, thereby allowing a large number of people to contribute to the process of discovery. Yes?
Is number one a polymerase?
Yes.
Then the model doesn't show the polymerase stops in size 8 minutes.
That's right.
And that's on the contrary.
Yes. So, yes. Exactly. There's something going on with protein synthesis regulation. Initially, when I built this model, I had the typical 2 to 3 minute half-life decay rates for the T7 message. This plot matched perfectly, or much, much better. It was painful to go in and adjust the half-lives to make them 20 or 30 minutes, because mRNA decay is the natural way you would expect protein synthesis to be downregulated. It seems like there's a more active inhibitor in this system, or something else that's actively regulating.
But has the mRNA half-life been measured just in bulk on average or individual transcripts?
For some individual transcripts, it's not been across the entire genome individually. But yes, for some individual transcripts. We don't have any mRNA, really nice mRNA time course data for T7, which is a gaping hole, which I'm working to fix. Part of the complication with that is, if you go back and think about the different messages that are produced, especially with incomplete digestion at the RNase 3 sites, the assays, you'd have to deconvolute the data to get individual message species, or be very careful in the design of your probes.
So when one turns off, you're saying that it is not known, or it is known, whether the mRNA is still floating around in the cell at that point?
I can't tell you if the message for this protein is here at this point. People in vitro assays have and at bulk assays have looked and seen that the message is probably there, but I can't say absolutely. But I believe the data enough to think, and if you look at the message, there's some really funky structures at the ends that would make it seem like it's pretty stable. But I don't have absolute data, but I felt strongly enough to not use just the bulk half-life of 2 to 3 minutes typical for coli. So ones that biologists don't believe, but the engineers like to believe, are exhaustion of resources and competition for resources relating to synthesis and differential translation. And also competing for ribosomes, which is very, very hard for biologists to believe. That's been shot down every time it's been suggested. Yeah, but if somehow these were able to discriminately get, you know, more ribosomes than the early genes, right? There could be a bunch of other things that we just don't know about. We'll get to the fact that there are, you know, 26 uncharacterized small genes that have quantitatively important effects. So
you clearly have here two stages: before 8 minutes and after 8 minutes.
Yeah. I think there's actually three. There's some other ones down here which are around this, and then this is another middle region. But yeah, yes, absolutely. The model fails. Yes, Terry. Okay, so if you plug in the typical coli mRNA half-life of 2 to 3 minutes, this plot here looks much more like this plot. The default way of regulating protein synthesis is to get rid of the message.
So what is it doing instead?
Instead, what I did was I increased the half-life of the T7 message to, actually in this model, I've effectively made it infinite, or zero decay. It's so far as we know, it's greater than 30 minutes, which is greater than the time scale relevant to the infection.
That's
very old experimental data that needs to be revalidated.
What's making it so long?
The arguments have to do with the fact that you're getting, it looks like, really weird hairpin structures at the 5' and 3' ends. And sometimes those are actually used, I think, to target things for degradation. So it's... Some of those were done in extracts. Some of those were done in extracts where people were looking at individual message. Some of those were done in bulk extracts as well. I can pull those papers for you. I probably have them. I don't have the details of that experimental protocol uploaded right now. Okay. We'll come back to those things. Replication and assembly. I can talk about this. I mean, this should clue you into the fact that things aren't as cleanly represented in the model, or it's not as high resolution. But for instance, the process of capsid assembly has been best studied by Jonathan King and Peter Prevlich in P22, which is a phage that looks kind of like T7 and has the same size particle. So actually what I've done is I've co-opted their biochemical data and used that to represent T7 capsid assembly. Then in terms of particle assembly, we assume that the packaging of the DNA into the particle by the terminase enzymes, that is the translocation of the DNA, which is like 28 kilobases per minute, is the limiting step in particle assembly. And then presuming that you have stoichiometric amounts of all of the other particle proteins, you instantly make a particle. So things become much less sophisticated, not that they were overly sophisticated before, as you get towards the end of the growth cycle. And then lastly, we're not including lysis, mainly because we don't have a real good mechanistic relationship between the lysis proteins and the lytic event, that is the destruction of the cell membrane. Despite Ra Young's continuing great work on that. We just don't have the physics there at all to begin to formulate that. Yeah? You're going to have to repeat that, I'm sorry. Yeah? So the DNA is, the infecting strand of DNA gets into the cell, that's used for expression. It also is used to make many, many more copies of the DNA. It's those copies of the DNA which are packaged. So all of protein, gene expression and protein synthesis takes place more or less before packaging, if that answers your question. Yeah. Oh, okay. So right. I'm painfully aware of how this works. So here's a replicated piece of DNA. It has a specific site on it. Here's a capsid with a portal structure. And you have an enzyme, which is usually composed of two subunits called a terminase. And this subunit recognizes a specific region on the DNA. This subunit recognizes the portal. This subunit typically has an ATPase site and spools the DNA into the portal, through the portal into the capsid. No, so far as we know, no. Sorry. Okay. It's usually near the end, these sites, if you look across phage, like lambda, P22. When DNA is replicated, it's not replicated. It's the DNA that's packaged, the substrate for packaging, is not an individual monomer of the genome, it's a concatomer. You get 10 mers of the genome. So you get a 400 kilobase region instead of a 40 kilobase region. So middle end, you're not, okay. Here's the last slide, we'll take a break, and then I'll show you some application of this and some more perturbations and experiments. So this answers the original question posed in 1994, why are these mutants growing faster? So sorry for no error bars, but they would be large. this is the wild type phage on Coli BL21. This is the observed intracellular burst per infected host. So it's progeny per infected host. I'm artificially lysing the cells with chloroform to get at the intracellular phage because I'm not bottling lysis. This is the output of the simulation. So simulation is fast and I'm overestimating yield. This is the strain that was deleted for those two genes that were arising in those mutants in the plaques. T726 is that strain, has to grow on a different host. It is growing a little bit faster in the lab. It's growing a little bit faster. It's expected to grow faster as well from the model with a slightly higher yield. This isn't significant here. I think this difference clearly is significant. This is the original model made wherein sort of subconsciously or didn't really care about being careful about specifying the parameters in the model. And the output matched perfectly. So, you know, this is trivial to do. This, I think, becomes a lot more meaningful, as we'll see after we take a break.
5 minutes break.
So this is now to the stuff that I think is approaching something that's interesting, actually. So now that you have a simulation that you know what it's good for or not, what I'd like to point out is I think there are a lot of interesting new scientific questions you can begin to frame and approach using such a representation like this. So for instance, in T7, it turns out that the position of a gene regulates the time of first expression, whether it's at the beginning or end. It's a clean way that you can regulate that. And then the position relative to the regulatory elements affects the level of expression. It's not completely independent of timing, but because there are so many promoters and a couple terminators at least, it's not completely dependent on position or timing, rather. So T7 turns out to be a really nice model system for asking how position of a gene and as you change position, how that affects timing and level of gene expression, how that affects, in turn, phage development. So it's just a really nice question to ask using this system. If I move things around, thereby changing the timing and level of expression, how does that affect phage growth? So can I make predictions doing that? Can I explore that and see what happens? So here's from the model what happens when I take this gene encoding the major capsid protein and slide it or move it back and forth on the genome. So map this down onto the genome here. This is expected growth rate. And you see, this is the wild type position. It's the highest computed growth rate. This is a normalized plot. And if you put it at the beginning upstream of all promoters, it's not expressed. It's essential. The phage doesn't grow. And at different regions, you have different expected growth rates.
Is this an experiment?
We'll get to that. Well, it's, so far, this is output of the model. The point that's interesting here, if anything, is that the wild-type position of the gene produces the highest expected growth rate. Same sort of plot, now sliding the gene encoding the T7 polymerase back and forth. Here's the wild-type position. Again, it's essential, thereby no growth if at beginning. And again, you see this sort of change as a function of position. What was interesting to us in this case was that there were regions where if you reposition the gene, the virus was expected to grow faster as based on the model. So here's an instance where I made 1, 2, 3 as represented by the green diamonds strains in the lab and characterized them experimentally to see if this qualitative hypothesis of something growing faster than wild type and something growing slower than wild type played out. Zero.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there a qualitative reason that you can understand why it's so
effective? Yeah. So it has to do with the fact that when you put the gene down here, it's now downstream of a couple promoters for the T7 RNA polymerase, so you get weak self-expression. And what this does is it provides a pulse of higher than normal active T7 RNA polymerase at the beginning of expression. So as to use more words like this, it's a turbo boost for transcription. At the very beginning of expression, this leads to slightly faster growth. And this is also a case where it's not clear that the deterministic representation is appropriate. So if you have a feedback loop like this and the source and decay terms are balanced, you get a lot of, I think, noise in the system. If it's weak source and strong decay, it'll just be near zero, and then it'll saturate otherwise if it's inverted. But the point here was, it seemed like it would be a bigger feat to make an improvement to this still arbitrary, but by default, we expect to be optimized system. And cutting to the chase, so this is the wild type growth cycle. This is the growth cycle of the mutant that was expected to grow faster. And when I put that gene and repositioned it downstream, the actual growth cycle was significantly worse. Here was the wild type growth cycle, the growth cycle of the mutant expected to grow much more slowly, this strain here. And if you look at the experimental data, it does grow much more slowly. In fact, it grows still more slowly. So this was good, that was bad. Yeah, I should have that on the same plot, but if you... I'm sorry, this is bad. Sorry, I have a visual here. Bad. Good. Yes, if I should have it on the same plot. I don't because it wasn't done in the same... Well, no, it was actually. The wild-type experimental data is going to be slightly slower here than the wild-type curve, and it'll be the same data over here. We went into that. So what I did was I did the same sort of protein synthesis rates experiments for all of these ectopic repositioning of the T7 RNA polymerase genes and looked to see what was going on. And so the experiments are, here's the wild type protein synthesis. In this case, just looking at the T7 RNA polymerase, here's the protein synthesis for the three different strains. Faster than wild type, same as wild type, slower than wild type. And the way I decided to represent this data, because I actually had this for all proteins I could detect via labeling with S35, was to quantify it and scale it relative to the wild-type protein synthesis rate. So what you see here is the rate of synthesis in the mutant expected to grow faster relative to the rate of synthesis in the wild-type. And the scale here is shown below. This is no change. Blue is a downregulation in synthesis relative to wild type. And as you go to red, that's an upregulation in synthesis. And then this is the computed data. I can spend some more time going through this if you like.
So the failure lies in what you identified before.
Probably. And in fact, what we saw was that this is, yeah. And in fact, what we saw was the problem of regulating protein synthesis was made worse in these strains for reasons we don't particularly appreciate. But it was, again, an indication that it wasn't simple mRNA decay.
So to reiterate, I mean, you put in the 2 to 3 minute decay rate and it still got the same?
I actually did not go back and do that. But
your model was developed without this data.
Yes.
Was it used to fit data like
Oh.
Could you imagine taking a number of mutants in the wild type and directly fitting the data to your time series?
Sure, but yeah. Yes, you could imagine. Yes, you could do that.
That's the kind of thing we're gearing up to do. And then the more mutants you can make that are, especially mutants like this that are well characterized in respect to your model, but you know how things could change if you move this guy. Presumably most of the parameters in the model shouldn't change if you move this,
right.
this gene from one
right.
to the other.
Yeah.
It'd be really cool.
Right. So it may be a way to sort of bridge the sort of top-down and bottom-up model-building approaches to do something like that. What I worry about is in making that sort of... I know for a fact that I'm not representing the richness and subtlety of T7 biology in my model. My model turns out to be a T7-like thing, but it certainly isn't T7. And I have no doubt that my model, though, is complicated enough such that it could be fitted in such a way to represent the behavior of almost any mutant we could produce at this point. There's enough dials and knobs.
It's not clear that you can fit it to represent all
right.
And but that question, it would be useful to have an answer.
Yes.
It would be useful to know whether your model is incomplete or just your parameters aren't quite...
I'm pretty sure this model is incomplete.
Well,
but I agree. I agree in principle.
You can leave out consistently your data so far.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
This is extending this analysis for every protein we could get data for. So here is the strain that was expected to grow faster. These are the different proteins. This is time post-infection. You see that there's, for example, take this protein 1, the RNA polymerase. There's no change relative to wild type in this strain expected to grow faster. It's downregulated initially because it's moved a little bit downstream in the genome. It takes longer to get into the cell. It's expressed later. This is relative to wild type. So this strain, in this strain, expected to grow faster than T7 wild type. Protein 1, its synthesis rate is, there's no change initially because it's not being expressed in, it's not being synthesized in either the wild type or this mutant. Its rate is downregulated initially relative to wild type because it's expressed later. And then its synthesis is higher than wild type because it has this weak feedback, auto-expression, if you will. That, in turn, increases the expression of everything downstream that depends on the T7 RNA polymerase for transcription. Here was a strain that was expected to have no change. Basically, you're seeing that there's a slightly longer lag because of delayed entry, and then more or less no change. Here was a strain that was expected to have a much slower growth cycle. Entry is much, much slower, and protein synthesis is grossly downregulated. Here's the experimental data. I don't know if the blueness matches up well, and you certainly see a big depression here. But the point to make is we're getting an upregulation of the early genes relative to wild type early. This gets back into, and I'd have to deconvolute the explanation, but it gets back to the issue of protein synthesis regulation. So this seems to be the major failing. The other major failing is it's not clear that this auto-expression of the T7 RNA polymerase is actually happening. So that was something I did some more experiments to test and couldn't find that. Okay, here's another thing to consider. Of the 56 genes, we don't really know anything for these. And they don't look like they're big, but for instance, the strain where I was making, the strain that I made expected to grow faster than wild type was by cloning into a unique restriction site in gene 1.7, which had been uncharacterized. And I was naive enough to believe that what I was told, that it had no importance. And it qualitatively doesn't have any effect on growth. You get the same yield per infected cell. But when I went back and did the controls and just knocked out this gene, I found that T7 DNA replication was grossly delayed and that the timing of development was reduced. It was about 50% slower. So there's this whole issue of, you could approach this in two ways, or think about this in two ways. One, by trying to represent the dynamic behavior of this system, I now consider things that have that are quantitatively important but qualitatively non-essential to be worth studying. So vast expansion of phenotype. That's probably the best way to think about it. The other way to think about it is I should have cloned this into an intergenic region cleanly. And that there's so many other problems that we'll see. But some of the other things I cloned into and disrupted, like 3.8, for instance, no effect. Right? So that I could detect.
How small these are.
Right. So here's last night I sort of go through this every now and then to see what we're doing, how we're doing. So here's 4.7, which is the average length is about 88 amino acids. This is a short answer. Here's one that's 135. As of last night, it pulls up itself, and this is not impressive as a homology. So the point here is there's a real limit. This is obvious, right? There's a real limit to how far you can go with homology searching for function. It has to do with the fact that our data set is not exhaustive or internally orthogonal or complete data set. And it'll be interesting to see how the protein function consortiums manage to strategically populate the data set such that we don't have problems like this anymore. But there are gaping holes right now. This can be repeated for about at least a dozen of those proteins, some of which probably are just artifacts and haven't been weeded out yet. I don't know. It's also something that, to go back, one of the things we're finally setting up to do is to knock out all of these and do protein synthesis pulse chase experiments. It's trivial experiments to do, and we'll see if there's any dynamic behavior. Okay, so coming back to the idea that I have a T7-like model, and I don't really believe anymore, and you shouldn't either, the specific predictions of the model, but I think the qualitative population-level predictions of the model seem to be a little bit stronger. So here's an instance where, suspending disbelief, I just started making complete permutations of the genome. and running hundreds of thousands, up to millions now, of permutations, and looking at how different things were distributed. I'm not really sure what fitness means for any living system, even a lytic phage. So it must have something to do with growth rate, but is it growth rate and then something to do with maximum yield, or what? It probably, most likely, must have to do, rather, with the environment this thing sees, which isn't the lab, which is the sewers. But sewers haven't been around that long either. So I'm not really sure where this thing is coming from and what it's optimized for. So I was interested to see how this wild type permutation did relative to randomly chosen permutations. And so this is a distribution for 100,000 permutations of growth rate from none to high. The dashed line is the wild type growth rate. No, because I'm not representing a lysis. So the growth rate in this particular plot is defined as, I was defining it in two different ways. They qualitatively can't distinguish between the outcomes. One way was the time to 99% maximum yield. The yield at 99% maximum yield divided by the time it took to get there, log of that. And the other was log of the maximum of the function, log of yield divided by time. So the first case is if there are no other hosts to infect and you want to make the biggest burst and hope that the particles hanging out in the environment find something else. The latter is based on the idea that as soon as you become at all resource constrained and stop having exponential intracellular growth, get out and find a new host, presuming there are lots of other hosts to infect, infinite hosts to infect. The objective functions, you know, it's not clear what to use. No, I'm including in the array the genes and the regulatory elements.
So there are, like all the coders that were in the original genome are sort of stuck to various...
No, they're independent.
They're independent.
They're independent.
So you have a bunch of occurrences where the coder ends up in the middle of the genome?
No, so again, this is exploiting the idea that we're using functional genetic elements as our basic thing that's being moved around in the model.
Right, I'm just asking how you...
Right.
Where are the promoter simulations?
This is model. If I could figure out how to do these experiments.
It would be okay, fine.
I've been working for a couple of years now to do these experiments.
No, I understand you're moving. I'm just curious, then what you scrambled the genes into the functional blocks.
And
then you've got a bunch of promoters and terminators and RNA sites too.
Yes.
They move with the genes and then they get put at different places.
You have a single array. There are, in this instance, 72 movable elements. Those elements include genes, promoters, terminators, RNase-3 recognition sites. Sometimes, when there aren't clean boundaries at the DNA level, sometimes you have genes that overlap by several nucleotides. Those are combined as one functional element that gets moved together.
Okay.
So we're trying to avoid disrupting things that would be obviously bad to disrupt. We're probably disrupting in the model any number of things that are bad to disrupt, and we just don't know it yet.
Did anybody look to the modern isolates?
They're a bunch of T7-like phage. They have different permutations. The permutations are not as clean as you would expect. That is, the borders of the permutations aren't defined by the elements, aren't defined by our arbitrary description of functional genetic elements. Yes.
In the lab, where you know what you're selecting on, so you can simulate that?
Yeah, that was the original problem we set out to answer. This thing that was evolving, it was faster, it deleted for two genes. We wanted to understand that. There's nothing sort of that I would label as non-trivial where that's been done. You can evolve T7 in the lab and get mutations that arise that aren't permutations, that aren't obvious why they're growing faster. There are changes within ORFs. Regardless, in this case, so we were getting out of this 2% of the randomly chosen permutations were expected to grow faster. About half were expected not to grow, and we got some distribution. And it turned out that this distribution was very sensitive to the representation of the environment that the phage was seeing upon it initiating infection. That is, how many ribosomes, polymerases, nucleotides, amino acids, were available for phage growth. And this represents approximately an infinite set of resources. As you changed that, you would see that this whole distribution would shift, and I'll show you that in a second. But the thing that I found, which is interesting from something like this, is, again, I know I can evolve T7 in the lab such that it grows faster than wild type. My model is predicting that there are variants of T7 that grow faster than wild type. My model is not good enough to allow me to determinately perturb T7 in such a way that it makes mutants that grow faster. But I think that this agrees with my intuition and what we know to be true. It's just that the mapping from model to experiment reality isn't good yet. Another way to, so I want to show you some data. I showed this several years ago, and it was hard to explain then. And so let's start with this, right? But I think you would find it rather interesting. And this is where I'm imagining this sort of work going. So I apologize for this. I was just slamming this in last night. So this is a crude representation of a cell, E. coli, as a function of growth rate and how different things are changing. For example, the number of active ribosomes, which goes over to this axis. The genome copy number, which you're probably aware of, the cell volume, NTPs, goes over on this axis. So a bunch of things are changing. As you map things on the growth rate, so far as the phage is concerned, it looks like you're increasing resources for phage growth. So what would happen if you take, so what I did was I took a set of 10,000 randomly chosen permutations and the wild type and looked to see how they grew in different environments. And then I tracked their trajectory through the environment space, if you will. I'll show you what that look like. I can only plot a couple of these at a time, and the first plot will be, so this is that same axis, it's not labeled, so this is a like point, well, okay. Slow growth, low resources, fast growth, high resources. This is the wild type genome, and so it gets better as the resources get better, and it's pretty good in resource-scarce conditions. But in resource-rich conditions, a lot of the random permutations, and if I showed you the complete data set, this would be more apparent, there'd be a significant number around that 2% fraction that are popping out and doing better than wild type. So the first thing I was interested in was this crossover point. It's not a perfect crossover, but maybe somewhere around here, the wild type stops doing relatively really well and starts to do pretty good. So I think what this must say is it must say something about the environment the system sees or was optimized for. That is, you would expect the average environment encountered by this thing would be less than this level. I'm not sure if that's, you know, that's just an assertion. The other thing it says is these things that are really, really good under resource-rich conditions are less good, typically, under resource-poor conditions. So this comes back to the idea that the things that grow well in the lab are not insensitive to resource poor conditions or variation in environment. So, you know, Formula One, wild type is SUV in terms of automobiles, if you want to think about it that way. It's really good under a well-defined environment. The wild type seems to be relatively good over a range of environments.
Honda, you mean, not SUV.
Well, sure. Honda makes those now, too. Here was something else I couldn't understand. When I looked at this set, I was finding other things, and this is sparse sampling on the resource axis, which is why these curves are disjointed. But most things, their growth rate was expected to monotonically increase as resources got better. Some permutations seemed like they had an optimal environment. I have no idea why this is. It's about 1% of the random permutations. I should point out that probably because I don't have this is from the random sampling, that 1% fraction that has what appear to be an optimal environment. So one of the fundamental problems I'm facing right now is I can't discriminate, if you were to give me a permutation without a simulation, a good genome from a bad genome, and all sorts of questions associated with that, which we could talk about. And I would be interested in thinking about ways of doing that. Okay. In the last couple minutes, I want to do two things. I want to show you science fiction-y application if you actually had validated models for biological systems with respect to drug development. And then I'm just going to talk briefly about what I think about all of this, given my experience. So here was something we did relatively early on, trying to be practical, although this isn't going to be practical for decades. We said, what's the best thing to inhibit in this virus's growth cycle if we want to stop it from growing? How much drug do we need to add per specific target in order to stop it from growing? So we represented here antisense, which is a piece of oligonucleotide that either complements message and blocks translation or hits, could be an RNA virus and blocks replication or transcription, or it could be blocking transcription. But anyway, it's one-to-one stoichiometric inhibitor. So if you take antisense message targeting, an antisense targeting the message of the capsid protein, and you go from a dose of 0.1 per the normal amount of message to 10 times the normal amount of message of your inhibitor, you get an inhibition function that looks like this. And this curve here is the latent period in minutes, going from just under 30 minutes for wild type at this temperature, and relatively quickly going up. Compare that with, for example, the antisense targeting this. It comes up more steeply, but at a higher dose relative to the wild type amount. You see some things which have, you actually stimulate if you dose. You see some things where you get a stimulation and then an inhibition at higher dose. So we started thinking about stuff like this, and so the reason this might be interesting down the road is that you could think about, instead of, for example, dosing way out here, you might think about combining or looking at multiple dosing strategies that combine low-level inhibition here with low-level inhibition here to get a greater than additive effect. So this is a sort of first-order screening through it. You could do compound interaction screenings or multiple target screenings. But here's where it gets, I think, really interesting. So what we were doing is we're going to come back and look at these two curves in more detail. This one and this one, 10A and 1, the capsid and the RNA polymerase. And instead of just looking at dose, we're now going to look at dose and the strength of the interaction between the target and the compound, the antisense. So for something targeting the capsid, here's the dose, molecules per cell. This is the binding constant from weak to strong. And the height of the surface represents the latent period, or you can think of it as degree of inhibition. What you see is you increase the dose or the strength, you get a monotonic increase in inhibition. Here's the surface for the inhibitor targeting the T7 RNA polymerase. Zero dose, zero strength, normal latent period. As you increase, you get a surface that isn't monotonically increasing, that has this ridge of maximum inhibition. And these are just contour plots for these two surfaces. So what's different about these two targets that's creating these two surfaces? Why might it be interesting? So with respect to why it might be interesting, consider the following in this case. So let's say you've now decided to inhibit this by dosing at this point on this inhibition surface. And you either have pre-existing mutations in the messenger RNA that bind the antisense less well, or those mutations arise naturally. And as you do that, you move in this direction, most likely, along this axis. As you move in this direction along this axis, you begin to reduce the inhibition. Those mutations or existing components of the population will be selected for, and you see drug resistance developing. When we first saw this plot, we thought it was cool because it meant that you could dose at an intermediate interaction strength and get better than perfect interaction strength inhibition. About 6 months later, we started thinking, actually, no, you want to dose here and use this ridge as a barrier to maintain the inhibition. So the idea being that as mutations arise that reduce the interaction between the drug and the target, depending on the delta, that is the change in the KEQ per mutation, if it's so big that it just burrows right through or tunnels right through this barrier, this thing isn't relevant. But if it's small enough such that these things encounter this, they would actually be selected against. So the idea is there something about the system dynamics or the system architecture that as a drug designer of the future you could exploit to make drugs that were first order resistant to evolution? I should point out that we actually did some more stuff with this, and it's possible to make a series of mutations, about 20 different mutations, it seems like. You would have to change almost all of the promoters in T7 to make this ridge go away. But it would be possible to get rid of this, but I'm not sure it's a direct selection, so I don't know that it would happen. So let me try and show you, so far as we know, the general reason this ridge happens. So the idea is as follows. You have some pathway, and this is your product or your output. And in the case of the T7 RNA polymerase, it expresses an inhibitor of itself, and it also expresses some inhibitors of its transcription. So there's actually two negative feedback loops. And what we're doing is we're inhibiting an intermediary. We're inhibiting the message of the RNA polymerase. And the idea being as follows. So this is to try and explain the difference between the plateau here, where you have inhibition, but not as good as when you're on the ridge. How does that work? So the idea is as follows. If you have perfect inhibition here, if this is a solid line, you basically block the pathway until the point where you titrate out the inhibitor and the pathway can proceed as normal. So if you look at, so here's the wild type time course for active polymerase and message of gene 2, which is just downstream. This is the plateau region, and what you're seeing is you're basically deferring the same time-dependent behavior of the system. You're just introducing a lag as the inhibitor is titrated out. But if you have an imperfect interaction between the inhibitor and the target, there's some leakiness, if you will, and that allows the negative feedback loop to begin at a low level. And what you end up doing is superimposing your inhibition with the negative feedback loop, which results in a lower level of expression, which means that you don't titrate out the inhibitor as quickly. This is obviously dependent on the parameters of the system. I think, though, we made some progress on trying to generalize this for negative feedback loops. It's also important to point out that I believe this is obviously a dynamic property of the system. It requires the fact that you're looking at the time it takes for something to occur. Yeah. Yeah. So
you could make these things and do experiments
with them? Yeah, sure. So I should back up and say, why would you bother making a representation of a biological system at the level of molecular entities? Known molecular entities interacting with each other. There are two reasons. One is there seems to be an experience of molecular biology that this is a useful and valid way of representing biological systems. The second is it makes it trivial to suggest direct actual experiments. Those are the two real benefits from this. Okay. So I've been spending a lot of time and burning a lot of energy in the lab actually trying to do all of this right. So consider everything you saw to be a first order hack for this. Here are some of the problems I'm facing. So let's say I wanted to do those permutations correctly. Well, the system is really frightening when you think about rearranging things like that. So this is an arbitrary sequence, meaning there's lots of examples like this in T7. And what I want to point out is there are a lot of functional elements. I can't really define their boundaries, and they're right on top of each other. So I don't know how to disrupt or move them. And nobody's done anything like this. Or the instances where people have done this have been for a very small number of cases, not in T7 again. So here's the stop codon for 3.5. Here's the next promoter, Phi3.8. This whole underlined region forms a hairpin, which is an RNase 3 recognition site where a message is cut. This is the start of the message from this promoter. Here's a ribosome binding site, and here's the start of the next gene. So you can see like TTAA, so this whole thing is going to form probably at least a structure there. And as I thought about trying to do these permutations in a reasonable way, I got really, I didn't like my chances for success, because I would be disrupting things that nobody's disrupted before. And the characterization it would require to do this in the lab is significant.
Have you ever tried doing circular?
No, but we've set up to do that. We've actually done things like package T7 into Lambda and get it to circularize upon infection. So we can do that, but we haven't done that yet. And as an aside, T7 grows better when you package it into Lambda. And it injects in the lab, T7 grows better when it doesn't have the delayed long entry process, but its genome gets in quickly. I can talk about that later. But there are two approaches I've been taking. One is to sort of refactor T7, to split these things up, put well-defined handles or boundaries on them, characterize the non-essentials, do a whole bunch of biology. I was really scared about doing that. I thought it would take decades. It probably will. We're starting to do that finally. In the meantime, the alternative approach, in part inspired by what Michael and other people have done, but also just from thinking about this problem, is instead of trying to model an existing phage, let's make a phage that can be modeled. And so we've been spending a lot of time, for instance, if you think about the model, I was using the P22 data to represent the capsid. So why not actually take the P22 capsid and use it in the experimental system? There's a whole bunch of protein engineering involved in doing that. We're in the weeds of that right now. It may not be successful. But so there are two different approaches here, and I can maybe talk about that later. The goal, though, is to create a combined modeling and experimental platform that lets you go after questions relating to how does the information represented in the environment make it into the system? What is this thing optimizing? Stuff like that. I think there's a lot of cool science to be done. Jumping gears for a second, some of you may have seen this, maybe not. This is a really first order, zeroth order, large-scale DNA synthesizer, which makes about 15,000 bases a day. Of 60 mers, and that was state-of-the-art 2 years ago. And Rob Carlson has been noodling around making a plot which I find rather interesting. It's not necessarily, it's just maybe, it's only maybe suggested, right? So this is transistors per chip, Moore's law. This is rate of sequencing as a function of time. This is mainly ABI machines. This is looking like pyro sequencing, which if you haven't seen is a really cool thing. And then this is the rate of synthesis. These, again, ABI machines. These are some of the parallel machines like what I showed you just before. And this is the rate at which a single molecule of T7 RNA polymerase can make DNA per day. So we're probably going to break that right now. And what that means is, in the context of synthesizing new systems, whether they're design systems for particular functions or refactoring existing systems, the infrastructure is coming. What's limiting is we don't know how to specify what changes to make, so we need to set up to just basically do high-throughput perturbation studies. I find this amazing. To be fair, though, it's a much different problem to take a lot of small oligonucleotides that you get off these machines and make a 40 kb fragment. People have made things of size 30 kb. And it looks like that could be extended to megabase. So it's hard, but not impossible. The problem will be solved. Okay, so last thing. This is what I think in general. This idea of modules is a nice idea. I worry about what it really means, and I think in order to really cleanly define modules, we have to understand what function means. And I think understanding what function means is at least as important, if not more, as is having a complete description of the molecular components of a system and their interactions and all the kinetic parameters. So the great example of this is in bacterial chemotaxis, where you can describe the process physics, you know the problem the thing has to solve, and John last week was describing how this imposed, in his opinion, certain limits on the possible solutions. A whole bunch of other people have made progress on that. It's not clear that we've made a lot of progress as scientists in defining what the functions or constraints of biological systems are outside the realm of sensing. And I think there are probably lots. And you know, our intuition just sort of dries up inside the cell, I think. We need a much better description of environment. I don't know where T7 came from. The only way I can infer anything about that environment is to see if I can't back out what it's optimized for. I'd love to see a just at scale studies of what the input to biological systems is from the environment on different timescales. I think we need a better description of constraints from physics. Again, Coley chemotaxis is an example where shear forces dominate. I think some other people are doing interesting stuff looking at the maximum amount of computation you could do with arbitrary chemistries and surfaces. It's not clear whether cells are bumping up against other fundamental limits that might put bounds on how we think about what they're capable of doing. And then, as you've seen sort of as a theme from Michael and some other people, this is how I recognize it. Biology is a medium for creation. Natural selection or evolution is a default design algorithm. It's very constraining. The things that exist today in the living world are a natural subset of all possible things that could exist. Human beings in their best days have other ways of implementing design. So I run against a lot of social pressure, but as we're successful in building stuff, I think that goes away. So these are some people. Eric and Lynn work with me now. John Yin was my advisor and inspiration for the original T7 stuff. Ling Chong Yu was a grad student recoding T7. Ian Molyneux was the first biologist I worked with. Roger and Sydney are other biologists. Rob is a physicist. Coleman Lerner is a yeast biologist I'm working with. And Larry is a mathematician on some model methods, simulation methods development we're doing. The T7 model is online. You can download the code. There was an interactive engine at one point. It's offline because we changed machines. It'll be up within the month. The yeast pheromone signal transduction project is online as well, although we're data limited right now, but you can see where we're going with that. Thanks.